Hello, everyone, and welcome to Leaders in Elder Care, the interview series designed to share with you the faces of people who are doing great things to change the way that elder care is today. Joining us today is Chuck Gould. He is the National President and CEO of Volunteers of America. He provides leadership to one of the largest and most comprehensive nonprofit faith-based organizations. Just to give you an idea of the size of Volunteers of America, Chuck oversees an organization with 16,000 employees and 90,000 volunteers. Volunteers of America has combined revenues of almost $900 million and programs that help more than 2 million people in more than 400 communities. And the organization continues to grow. So before we get started, just a quick reminder to subscribe to the podcast. You can do so at InsideElderCare.com. In the top right-hand corner, there's a subscribe button, or also on iTunes if by searching for the Leaders in Elder Care podcast and clicking the subscribe button. Chuck, how are you doing today?
Doing well, thank you. How about yourself, Ryan?
I'm doing really good. I appreciate it. Thanks for joining us today. So let's dive right in. What is Volunteers of America?
Well, you've done actually a great job, Ryan, giving an overview of the organization. We're over a century old. We were founded in the 1890s, so we're 113 years old this year. And our mission has always been around poverty and vulnerability. So we work across the country with individuals who are homeless. We work with people with substance abuse addictions. We help low-income children and families. We work with men and women coming out of prison, getting back into their communities, help them find jobs, places to live. We provide group homes for people who are developmentally disabled. And amidst all of this wide array of human services, we also have a large focus on older Americans.
Very nice. Yeah, I would suspect with 90,000 volunteers that you've got a pretty good-sized umbrella on the things that you do. So tell me a little bit about what Volunteers of America does with seniors specifically.
Okay, we have, since our beginnings, we've recognized that as they age, people become more vulnerable, and that this has always been true. And the issues have changed somewhat. We have a number of different services to help people who are becoming frail in this country, and Volunteers America has really been part of just about each one of the new services that have developed over time. And so, for example, today, Volunteers America is the largest nonprofit provider of affordable housing in the country, and much of that housing is provided to seniors. We're the fourth largest nonprofit provider of skilled nursing care. We've been providing licensed skilled nursing care since the 1960s. We are the sixth largest nonprofit provider of assisted living. We were really one of the first organizations to pioneer assisted living facilities. And in addition, we have a wide array of community-based services that provide such support as adult day centers, home-delivered meals, congregate dining, really a wide portfolio of different kinds of services to help seniors as they age and as they become frail.
It's fascinating because when I was doing some due diligence on VOA last week to prepare for this call, you see so much advertising and publicity from the for-profit providers of senior
mm-hmm.
care. More than likely, most of them are the Big Ten, the Sunrises and the Brookdales and things like that. But I was floored when I found out, the way that you ranked in terms of being the nonprofit provider, because you obviously have the growth and the size, but you've done so in such a subtle way that it doesn't pop out when you look on the web and all that kind of stuff. So it was fascinating. It seemed like it must have been an organic growth as opposed to an advertising-driven growth.
I think that's right. Volunteers America has always been fairly quiet about how we go about our services. We've never felt that it's about us. And these services have grown in really almost concentric circles. You start small, and then you see another need that has to be met, and you find you can provide this service somewhere else where it's needed. And over time, as we've built this platform of volunteer and professional staff across the country, they've identified additional needs that they can take on, and over time it's become a significant scale where we're able now to learn from one another inside of our network and keep challenging how it is we should be providing services, and that's really something that we've put a real emphasis on lately. Is what is that next generation of service to seniors? How should we, as a country, be meeting this this growing need? And we've really begun to take a different view of what we should be doing at this point in our own history.
So what's the how does your philosophy differ from other organizations that provide elder care?
Well, I think that it helps. I think our philosophy is shaped somewhat by the fact that our outreach to older Americans is within the context of an organization that is concerned about a wide array of human services. And so what we've begun to do now, and our philosophy I think is changing this way, is to recognize that we need a much more integrated approach to how care is delivered. And for example, right now I've mentioned all these different kinds of services we provide in different communities, but the reality is those are a little fragmented, and they're somewhat fragmented because historically the funding for them has been fragmented. The regulatory schemes have been fragmented. They've been driven by programs like Medicaid or Medicare or nutritional support programs, but they tend to have their own kind of language and approach. We recognize today that as a result of that, we've not been as effective as we'd like to be in really driving down that institutional bias that exists in so many of the aging services in this country. And so we're in the process now of combining those services in a more effective way to achieve the outcome we want. And this is ultimately our philosophy, is that seniors ought to be able to live at home even as they age and become more frail, regardless of their means.
Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, we have three concepts that we're really pushing that draw on our experience, but that we think are fundamental in how different they are compared to how these services provided in the past. One of those is the concept of a PACE program for all-inclusive care for the elderly. This is something that we've launched in Western Colorado, and we've made a priority for Volunteers America to bring to more communities. And there will be other programs like this as well, but the basic idea is that we go at risk, Volunteers America goes at risk, to ensure that we are getting that outcome that is the core of our philosophy, helping people remain at home. And we're at financial risk to make that happen. And so we participate with Medicare and Medicaid in this program. And we take an amount that is less than it currently costs Medicare and Medicaid to pay for all the different fragmented services that they're providing to seniors in a given community.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the goal of using those dollars to help the individual remain at their home. So everybody who enters our PACE program,
right,
is certified by the state as needing nursing home care. But at any given time, only 6 or 7% of them are actually in a nursing home, and the rest are able to be cared for and get the support they need at home. And we can achieve this because we have a transportation system that brings them in. This is operating in rural communities, that brings them into our adult day center, where they see the physician, they see the therapist, they have a meal, they socialize, they get nutritional counseling. Our van driver is able to assess their environment when he picks them up, and he can see sort of what's needed there, how are they functioning at home, what additional supports do they need. We do an assessment of their home environment. If they need a ramp in their home to continue to stay there, we use these funds to do that. If it looks like they've had some shortfall and in their budget and they don't seem to have the groceries they need, we can actually make sure they get the groceries. So we do whatever we have to do to make sure that this individual can stay at home. And it really is all around eliminating that bias that currently exists in some of these funding systems toward institutionalized care.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So, we interviewed Sean Bloom,
yes,
from National PACE probably a month ago.
Yep.
And it was very similar. Obviously, you know, the concept and the funding is very similar, but he shared some really interesting stories about success stories about that,
yeah,
he had. And I think that one of the examples, if I remember correctly, was a woman who was in the doctor quite frequently, and it turned out that her issue when they finally went to her house was that her house was flea-ridden because of her pets. And once they got rid of that, she stopped becoming sick. And it was cool because you don't get that from more acute treatment.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It was really interesting.
How few preventive services there are, and what a difference they can make. If you're willing to spend more money up front in smaller amounts, you can avoid the huge expenses that come later from hospitalization or institutionalization.
Yeah, the policy problem, which you probably know well, is it seems so hard for the general public to conceptualize the value of prevention versus the hard dollar of actual spending. And I think that's a lot of the debate that's going on right now. Not to digress into a political discussion, but
no, but I think you put your finger on something that's essential, because what allows the PACE program to work is that it really cuts right through that Gordian knot of regulators saying, well, you know, if we pay this money now, people will come out of the woodwork and want the service. If we pay this money now, there's no guarantee that we won't also have to pay later. And what this does is to say, we'll take that risk.
Mm-hmm.
That if costs need to be incurred later, we're going to be at risk for those. But give us the flexibility to pay for the preventive services, because we know, even if the government doesn't have the confidence that preventive services will avoid these later extreme healthcare costs, we know that we can manage that care much more effectively earlier and avoid those later costs. So we are at financial risk to make sure that that happens. And I think that's a huge shift in how nonprofit organizations provide care, but it is very person-centered. It really says, we're going to manage the care for this individual. They're going to get the preventive services they need early on. They're going to be able to stay at home. And we're going to make sure that the government doesn't end up having to pay at the other end, because we're assuming that risk in the event that, in any individual case, increased costs are necessary.
So you mentioned three areas. One of them was PACE,
mm-hmm.
And then what are the other two?
There's two others that are components of this whole new approach we're taking, how Volunteers America implements this philosophy of helping people stay at home. Not everybody needs a PACE program. Not everybody needs to be brought into an adult day center through a transportation system three or four or five times a week.
Mm-hmm.
In many cases, people won't ever need that. They'll be able to age at home without that kind of support. So we have two other components. One is sort of at the very front end, lighter care than the intensive services of PACE, and it's really the naturally occurring retirement communities. It's the coordination of services to individuals who are living in the community, and they're living in a home setting that wasn't designed for aging necessarily. So they're not in congregate aging centers. And this, we think, is important, because the old idea used to be that in order to efficiently provide services to seniors, you had to congregate them. You had to move them into some kind of a retirement housing or senior housing. And the demographics are changing so dramatically that older adults are everywhere. You don't have to move them to congregate them. They're in the community, and we can bring services to them where they live. So there are many of these either apartment complexes or neighborhoods where people look around and say, you know, we're all older than, you know, we've all aged. We've all become old. When did that happen? And Volunteers America believes that we can help them stay in those communities if we can help them build a community and help them in the coordination of services that they want. So we do that by having a coordinator for service who can make sure that they're getting access to the right services in the community. We don't necessarily provide all of these, because they're available in the community, but we help them maneuver this very complex long-term care system and get access to the services and supports they need. We also help them build a community among themselves through such dimensions as volunteer banking, where they can volunteer time to help one another. That time is then banked, and then in the future when they need that help, they're able to draw down on that. So it really is getting them to look out for one another as well, so that it's not a professionalism of care. It's not a sense that all of this has to be bureaucratized and put into a caregiver frame of mind. it's trying to avoid that. It's trying to say we can maintain, help you. You can maintain your independence. We can all maintain our independence if we can recognize the community engagement and look out for one another and have just somebody who is able to be there as a trusted resource, a trusted partner. And that's what Volunteers America would like to be seen as, to help individuals maneuver the very complex system.
So it sounds like a nonprofit version of a geriatric care manager, but more on steroids because of the broader knowledge that they have than you would typically see from a geriatric care manager.
I think that's good. We might use that geriatric care manager on steroids. But in addition,
don't tell Major League Baseball about it.
There we go. The other dimension, however, that I wouldn't want to get lost is that it's not just a caregiver framework. It also is a community engagement framework. It's really getting them to look out for one another. So that's sort of the second. That's in some ways the first. That's sort of at the very entry level, if you will. It's the lightest touch. It's the least intensive. And then the pace is the third, if you will, even though I started with that. It's the most intensive. And then in the middle are home and community-based services that Volunteers America has provided in the past and will continue to provide. But it is it's recognizing that in some cases people need just individual support. They'll need, they may not be in one of these naturally occurring retirement communities, and they may not need PACE, but they'll need some additional support at home. And so that is a little more vague, if you will, because it will depend on the individual situation.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a recognition that there's really a continuum we're talking about. And in the middle is a tailored support for the individual that isn't one of these much more defined models.
Interesting. So would that be analogous to more of a traditional, you know, home care, home health type model that you would see?
It would be.
Okay.
It would be. We think there's a lot of different opportunities within that, and we'd like to have some experimentation in different communities. But it's the recognition that there isn't a one-size-fits-all. People will be somewhere somewhere along this continuum, and they may not move along it. It may not be a continuum for the individual. They may not move from a NARC to home and community-based service to a PACE.
Mm-hmm.
They may just stay right where they started, based, you know, depending on the community and their own needs. But the needs are along a continuum. What people are looking for and what they really need is varied, but they're generally in these three areas.
Wow, that's really interesting. Yeah, the reason I keep trying to create these analogies because I think that for many of the listeners, they're accustomed to kind of these more traditional models. So I think it helps them understand it a little bit better, hopefully. How obviously there's some challenges in putting all this together. How is Volunteers of America working to make these changes?
Well, the first is really an internal change. It is changing our own mindset from one that's been fairly fragmented and sort of a sense of professional caregiver at some level into a recognition that we have got to really understand what it means to integrate services, that we have to shift from a place-based mindset to a person-centered mindset. And even though we have a lot of pride in the services that we've provided over the past century, when we look back on them, we've said, they were what they had to be at that point in history, but they tended to be very much focused on the place where they're delivered. So our senior housing was a place we developed, and we put certain features in the physical plant, and we thought about them in a certain way, and they were funded in a certain way, and operated in a certain way. And our long-term care facilities were a place, and we thought we knew who needed to be in that place, and then there were assisted living facilities as well. But there's very place-based. And at one point, we, like many of our colleague organizations, had this sense that there was a continuum of care, and people would kind of move through this continuum, that they would start in housing. They'd be in their own home, and they'd start in housing, and then they'd move into assisted living, and then they'd move into a nursing home. And that's all changed for us. We don't believe that people need to be helped to maneuver through our places. So it's a shifting in the mindset to a person-centered, where we believe that individuals can stay at home. some may choose to move into a more congregate setting for a variety of reasons, and some may not even have a very supportive home environment where they are an appropriate home environment. So they may choose to move, but we believe people can stay at home, and we're really shifting our systems and our approach and our philosophy and our mindset to really make that front and center. So that internal challenge is the one that we've been dealing with, and we think we've mastered, or at least have recognized our deficiencies and how to go about shifting that. The other, of course, is getting the rest of the country to shift along as well. And there are, you know, many other people who are, you know, part of this movement and who also have a recognition that this could be a very different experience in the U.S. for aging than it has been. But we have to get the government systems to change. We have to change the fragmented funding where Medicare funds are here and can just be used for this, and Medicaid can just be used for that, and very restricted, very regulatory, and very biased toward institutional care. So that has to change. So one of the biggest challenges we have right now is trying to get long-term care to be part of healthcare reform. And obviously, healthcare reform has its own set of challenges. But to the extent that it's reformed, which we think is necessary, long-term care has to be part of that. It really needs to be rethought. We have a Medicare system that will be bankrupt in 7 years, we're told. We have most of the people in the country believe that Medicare is going to provide for the long-term care, and you know that it doesn't. It's very acute care focused. It provides a little bit of nursing home coverage for people, but on average, it's like 26 days, I think, is the last figure I saw. But nothing like long-term care. Medicaid does provide long-term care, provided you've exhausted your resources, but it has still a very strong bias for nursing home care, for institutional care. And we've got, I think, 300 and some thousand people in the country on waiting lists for home and community-based services under Medicaid. So that all has to change for this to work. And if it changes, it will be a more socially acceptable model. It will be more person-centered. And frankly, it will be less costly. And with the demographics that we're seeing, you know, the doubling of the adults over age 65 in the next 20 years, it's just not sustainable. The system we have just isn't sustainable.
So have you random question, I'm just curious more than anything. Have you guys done any math on what the potential savings of, you know, one of the programs would be?
Well,
is there any kind of, from the movement and some of the, the lobbying and some things like that, is there any idea of the savings compared to maybe a traditional, facility-based model? Because there's so much FUD out there, right? So, a lot of people are going to listen to this recording, and I wanted to make sure if you had a number offhand that you wanted to share that you could.
Well, the numbers that I want to make sure I answer this responsibly, because we don't have numbers of our own that project the national savings through programs like this. We do have on individual programs. We know, for example, for PACE, that we're negotiating 90-some percent of what Medicare and Medicaid are paying now. So we guarantee that there's a savings there to that system.
Mm-hmm.
We've been following something called the CLASS Act, though. I don't know if you tracked that. Yeah, the CLASS Act.
Yeah.
And that would provide an alternative approach to funding long-term care. It would be a cash payment to individuals if they become disabled at whatever age. And the cash payment would depend on how many disabilities they have, and it depends in part on how the system is established, because it would be a payroll deduction to fund this cash payment disabilities model. That, however, that is interesting in how that's being scored, because it is it's showing some substantial savings depending on the different assumptions you use. But I don't have those top of mind. I happen to have come across those just the other day. But the numbers are moving around quite a bit at this stage in the healthcare reform discussions. So I'm afraid the numbers I threw out there would be pretty speculative right now. But I'd encourage anybody who wants to look at the potential savings to really follow the CLASS Act and look at how that's being scored, because it shows some tremendous savings. Because basically it helps people avoid getting on Medicaid later. It keeps
it's kind of like a national long-term care insurance plan, right?
It is national. It's like national long-term care insurance.
Yeah.
And the
but far less expensive in terms of premiums.
That's right, because you get a large pool. You're not limited to these people who think about it when they turn 55 or something, and then realize that it's pretty pricey at that point. You're really catching the entire working population.
So I mean, even if you do the I guess my last comment on the cost of, even if you do the basic math, right? If you just say, okay, let's make the whole country focus on PACE. 10% of the size of Medicare is an enormous savings.
It would be.
I think the point is that these alternative models are going to provide an incredible amount of savings. We just haven't, until you can extrapolate what it is across the country, it's hard to nail down a number. But 10% of Medicare is a big enough number to, it should make a lot of people interested.
That would be huge.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So moving on then. So maybe you can share a couple success stories with me.
Yeah, I guess I'm struck by the one that Sean shared about the woman and her pets. And what I'll do is move into some of what we're seeing on kind of a larger scale, because there are a lot of those anecdotes where individuals' lives are different because of how we're committed to helping them stay at home. But one of the successes we're seeing is by combining technology with this new approach. We have a device, a product, really, it's a whole technology system called WellAware that Volunteers America and another aging service provider have partnered on with the Research Institute to develop. And we have now installed this in a number of our assisted living facilities, and we're beginning to install it in individual homes. But we wanted to install it first where we could test it, where we had some staff available, and we could monitor it more closely. But this is a series of sensors that allow us to passively monitor an individual's environment. So we can tell when the stove's left on, we can tell if they've fallen, we can tell if they're restless in bed, we can tell how often they go into the bathroom at night.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of data that is collected, and it's electronically collected, and it creates a pattern for that individual. And when their pattern is altered, it provides information then to the healthcare staff that there's a change in the condition. And this allows us to determine early on, to conduct some tests, to question in certain areas. We are finding quite often, for example, UTIs or urinary tract infections or something else that are not self-reported, which we can detect because of the change in the pattern of activities. We catch
mm-hmm.
them early and really avoid the deterioration of the medical condition. It's amazing to me already what a difference technology is going to make in preventing the adverse medical events that used to cause somebody to have to go to the hospital, become destabilized. From there, they go to the nursing home, hopefully go back home eventually, but not necessarily. Now we can catch those much earlier and help them stay in their setting. So the whole use of technology is one area of success. The other is sort of the sense of what it means to provide these additional supportive services in people's homes. And we have really been testing this concept of the service coordinator that I mentioned for the naturally occurring retirement communities.
Mm-hmm.
We've been testing that too in our senior housing, and as a result, I think people are often surprised to find that the average age of seniors in our housing, in our independent housing, is now 82 years old. So these are people who, in the past, clearly would have been assumed to be in a nursing home at that point.
Right.
But because of this service coordination over time, where they're getting better access to services when they need them early on, their conditions are not destabilizing as quickly, and they're getting the support they need in that setting to remain there. So that's a second success story we're seeing. And the third is really one that people don't think about quite a bit, which is what is the role of the nursing care facility in this whole new model? Do they go away? will some people need nursing care? What we've found is that we've been able to shift our nursing care facilities to much more post-operative rehab services, where people are coming in for recovery after surgery because it's less costly than staying in the hospital, and they don't need the hospital platform anymore. They need a nursing platform.
So short-term instead of long-term?
Much more short-term.
Yeah.
If I contrast I'll take our Maplewood Care Center, which is in St. Paul, Minnesota, which was our first nursing care facility. When we opened that, it's been 40 years ago next year. The first 10 years, we provide care for 650 residents, so about 65 a year. Currently, we're admitting about 55 people a month, so it's about 10 times as many. Well, those are people who are coming in, staying for 14 days, going back home. They're much more of a rehab focus, whereas in the past, people would come in, they'd spend the final 2 or 3 years of their lives there, and that was the last place they would be, and they would deteriorate there. Now, people aren't coming in anymore who are going to be there for 2 or 3 years because they don't need to be in that kind of a setting. So we're seeing in the change in that component of a long-term care system, how successful really these other components are.
That's fascinating. I just think it's really interesting that these unique models are providing such like real measurable benefit, which it's cool. That's the whole point of the interview, so I'm really happy with what you are doing. So we talked a little bit about some of the challenges that you have going forward, and I think those are pretty clear in terms of policy and proving mm-hmm. out some of these models. If you had to kind of look into the crystal ball, where do you see VOA going in the near future?
Well, our immediate challenge is to get this fully implemented in our system to make sure that we're doing this well and get the bugs out of it where we still have the old models that have to be changed. And this is something that takes some time because we've got to make sure the funding catches up with this, regulations have to catch up with this. So we will be definitely working strong in advocacy. I think we're probably also going to see what we learn from these services and apply them to some of the other populations we work with. There is no reason, for example, that the same idea of being at risk as a provider of service, to be at risk for the outcomes, there's no reason this shouldn't work in other areas. For example, for men and women returning to their communities after prison, you know, you can't lock them up forever. They're coming out. You can either, you know, just wish them luck and hope they don't get back into the same cycle, or you can provide housing, help them find a job, get some job training, make sure they stay off drugs. There's no reason that rather than just getting a per diem payment to have them in a halfway house for a while, that you couldn't instead be at risk for those outcomes. So we think that we are going to learn from our aging services how to be better at achieving outcomes and absorbing financial risks to achieve those outcomes for many other services around this country as well. And frankly, when you look at the federal budget, you look at the state budgets, something dramatically different in terms of how we fund these services is desperately needed over the coming years. So that's part of where we think we're going, is to learn from this area.
That's cool. Yeah. There's certainly a lot of help that needs to be done in a lot of the areas that you mentioned. So that's really good that you're looking at it as something that's extensible to the different populations. So if people wanted to find out more information about yourself or VOA, how do they find you?
We're on the web at voa.org, volunteersofamerica.org, either one. And you can also call us at 1-800-899-0089.
Perfect. Well, Chuck, thanks so much for joining us today. It's really been an honor. You guys are doing some amazing things over there, and I'm really glad that we had a chance to have an extended conversation and share it with the folks that are listening.
Ryan, we appreciate the opportunity. Thanks for putting a spotlight on what we're doing.
Great. So, okay, so that wraps it up for today. I encourage all of you to visit Inside Elder Care, which is a family-based approach to helping you deal with issues around elder care for your loved ones. It's at www.insideeldercare.com. And Portrait of Our Parents, which is a storytelling website allowing you to honor an elderly loved one by telling a story about a unique memory or event that you had with them so that everybody can see it and enjoy it the same way that you did. It's at www.portraitofourparents.com. Thanks, everyone, for listening. I hope you come back and listen soon, and have a fantastic day.